Hello, today is Monday, and it is the 25th of January, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today stories of local, state, and national interest. We're going to start out with the 5-day forecast with the weather, go to the mini editorial, and then hit stories of the front page and subsequent pages of interest as we go along. So sit back and relax and enjoy hearing about today's news. Let's start with the Siouxland 5-day forecast. This morning, breezy and cloudy, high of 24. Tonight, considerable cloudiness with temperatures down to 13. Tuesday, cloudy with a flurry or two, high of 22, low of 15. Wednesday, low clouds, high of 25, low of 10. A little bit warmer as we get toward Thursday and Friday. Partly sunny Thursday, high of 27, low of 18. And Friday times with clouds and sun, high of 37, low of 26. So it looks like it's going to be a chilly week. And I was just watching the news and they were saying we might get some flurries. So be careful with that today. All right, I'm moving back to the front page here, and today's mini editorial is brought to us by Roger Wilson of Sioux City. And Roger says, "I now realize the social media giants are not silencing conservative ideas, not because it was hate speech, but because they hate the speech." This is the opinion of Roger Wilson. Okay, today, headline reads, "Threats aimed at lawmakers. Growing number of GOP senators oppose an impeachment trial." In Washington, D.C., federal law enforcement officials are examining a number of threats aimed at members of Congress as the second trial of former President Donald Trump nears, including ominous chatter about killing legislators or attacking them outside of the U.S. Capitol. The threats and concerns that armed protesters could return to sack the Capitol anew have prompted the U.S. Capitol Police and other federal law enforcement to insist thousands of National Guard troops remain in Washington as the Senate moves forward with plans for Trump's trial, the official said. The shocking insurrection at the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob prompted federal officials to rethink security in and around its landmarks, resulting in an unprecedented lockdown for Biden's inauguration. Though the event went off without any problems and armed protests around the country did not materialize, the threats to lawmakers ahead of Trump's trial exemplified the continued potential for danger. Similar to those intercepted by investigators ahead of Biden's inauguration, the threats that law enforcement agents are tracking vary in specificity and credibility, said the official, who had been briefed on the matter. Mainly posted online and in chat groups, the messages have included plots to attack members of Congress during travel to and from the Capitol complex during the trial. The official was not authorized to discuss any ongoing investigation publicly and spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. Meanwhile, a growing number of Republican senators say they oppose holding an impeachment trial, a sign of the dimming chances that Trump will be convicted on the charge that he incited the siege at the Capitol. House Democrats who will walk the impeachment charge of incitement of insurrection to the Senate on Monday evening are hoping that strong Republican denunciations of Trump after the January 6th riot will translate into conviction and a separate vote to bar Trump from holding office again. But GOP passions appear to have cooled since the insurrection, and now that Trump's presidency is over, Republican senators who will serve as jurors in the trial are rallying to his legal defense, as they did during his first impeachment trial. "I think the trial's stupid, and I think it's counterproductive," said Marco Rubio. He said, "The first chance I'll get to end this trial, I will do so." Mario Rubio believes it would be bad for the country and will further inflame partisan divisions. Arguments in the Senate trial will begin the week of February 8th. Leaders of both parties agreed to the short delay to give Trump's team and the House prosecutors time to prepare, and the Senate a chance to confirm some of President Joe Biden's cabinet nominees. Democrats say the extra days will allow for more evidence to come out about the rioting by Trump supporters who interrupted the congressional electoral count of Biden's election victory, while Republicans hope to craft a unified defense for Trump. An early vote to dismiss the trial probably would not succeed, given that the Democrats now control the Senate. Still, the Republican opposition indicates that many GOP senators would eventually vote to acquit Trump. Democrats need the support of 17 Republicans to convict him. When the House impeached Trump on January 13th, exactly 1 week after the siege, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, said he did not believe the Senate had the constitutional authority to convict Trump after he left office. On Sunday, Cotton said, "The more I talk to other Republican senators, the more they're beginning to line up behind that argument." I think a lot of Americans are going to think it's strange that the Senate is spending its time to convict and remove a man from office who left 1 week ago. Democrats reject that argument, pointing to the 1876 impeachment of a Secretary of War who had already resigned in opinions by many legal scholars. Democrats say that a reckoning of the first invasion of the Capitol since the War of 1812, perpetrated by rioters egged on by a president who told them to fight like hell against election results that were being counted at the time, is necessary so the country can move forward and ensure such a siege never happens again. A few GOP senators have agreed with Democrats, though not close to the numbers that will be needed to convict Trump. Senator Mitt Romney from Utah says he believes there is a preponderance of opinion that an impeachment trial is appropriate after someone leaves office. "I believe that what is being alleged and what we saw, which is incitement to insurrection, is an impeachable offense. If not, what is?" Romney, the lone Republican to vote to convict Trump when the Senate acquitted the then-president in last year's trial, appears to be an outlier. Senator Mike Rounds, Republican from South Dakota, said he believes a trial is a moot point after a president's term is over, and I think it's one that'll be very difficult. They would have a very difficult time in trying to get done in the Senate. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, tweeted on Saturday, "If it's a good idea to impeach and try former presidents, what about former Democratic presidents when Republicans get the majority in 2022? Think about it, and let's do what's best for the country." On Friday, GOP Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a close Trump ally who's been helping him build a legal team, urged the Senate to reject the idea of a post-presidency trial, potentially with a vote to dismiss the charge, and suggested Republicans will scrutinize whether Trump's words on January 6 were legally incitement. Rubio and Romney were on Fox News Sunday. Cotton appeared on Fox News Channel Sunday Morning Futures, and Romney was also on CNN's State of the Union. Rounds was interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press. So, that is the end of that article. We're going to go back now to the front page in a story of local interest. There's a very large picture of the Irving Elementary School, out the outside of the school, and vehicles in a line. Vehicles form a conga line in the parking lot as students get picked up from Irving Elementary School at the end of classes on January 18th. The school district is studying its feeder school system, and depending on the outcome, Irving graduates could switch from going to North Middle to East or West Middle schools. The title of the article is "Boundary Plan Up for Vote. Changes would affect where fifth graders go to middle school." A proposed change regarding which middle and high school some students will attend after the fifth grade is headed for a final Sioux City School Board vote on Monday. As its regular meeting Monday, it'll start at 6 p.m., the school board will consider a plan forwarded 2 weeks ago by a special boundaries committee, which has worked on the details since September. any changes approved would be phased in over the next few years, beginning in August of 2021, with fifth graders moving to middle school. There are changes that include which students will go to each of the three middle school and high schools, west, north, and east. The first recommended boundary change would switch Irving Elementary from being a feeder school to north middle and high schools so that the students would split going either to east or west depending on which direction they live from the dividing line, which is Virginia Street. However, since the north schools provide instruction for a large number of English language learners, it would lessen the magnitude of the change, according to school officials. In another recommendation, students who attend Unity Elementary who live north of 14th Street would go to north middle and high. Currently, all fifth grade students from Unity go to the east system. The third recommendation is that some Crescent Park Lincoln Elementary students who live north of Stone Park Boulevard will go to north, while others will go to west. Sioux City School Board member Dan Greenwell, who also serves on the Boundaries Committee, said the key thing is to have similar sized enrollments at Northeast and West High School. Board member Monique Scarlett is not on the committee, but looks forward to voting Monday on the recommendations, which blends three other options, and we end up dividing only three elementary schools instead of more. Our city is growing, she said. And I'm going now to the next page. The district needs the alignment. The concerns expressed about English language learners were addressed, and we will monitor the impact to ensure that our students are achieving and succeeding. School officials sought input from people living in the district since there could be an impact on current and future students. There was a November 30th virtual meeting about the proposed boundaries, where people were encouraged to give feedback. They could also do that through December 13th via an online portal. The district hired a consultant, RSP and Associates from Overland Park, Kansas, to provide an enrollment analysis, including population trends, demographics, enrollment data, and potential growth. Greenwell was a continuing critic on the quality of the demographic information provided by RSP, and on Friday he called them amateurs. School board member Jeremy Saints said lots of work went into the boundary considerations, and we got a pretty good outcome. The people on the committee include board members Saint, Greenwell, and Taylor Goodvin. Others include school district administrators Paul Gausman, Kim Berniak, Jim Vanderloo, Brian Bernight, Jen Gomez, Brian Fahrenholz, John Pritchard, and Mandy Mayo, along with six principals and assistant principals at the three high schools. Okay, we're moving back now to other front page news. County vaccine numbers are reported. In Woodbury County, 874 have gotten two doses. A total of 874 Woodbury County residents have received the full course of two COVID-19 vaccine doses, the Iowa Department of Health reported Friday. The county leads Northwest Iowa by far in that measure, though it ranks eighth in the state overall. Woodbury County is the sixth most populous county in Iowa and is the site of two major hospitals and several long-term care facilities. Nearly 13% of the county's population has had a known infection since the pandemic began 10 months ago. In neighboring Ida County to the east, only 14 residents have had both doses, while 23 in Monona County. Plymouth County, O'Brien, and Dickinson are each roughly tied for second in the region, behind Woodbury County at 183, 82, and 83 resident vaccines completed. The total of 4,111 doses of the vaccine have been administered to Woodbury County residents, meaning more than 2,300 residents have only had one dose. It appears that residents of neighboring counties have been coming to Woodbury County for a vaccine, as a total in the county is 6,725. Vaccines began more than a month ago. The shots to this point have been given almost exclusively to people in Phase 1A of the vaccine program, which consists of long-term care facility residents and frontline medical workers. Phase 1B, in which additional older people can begin to receive vaccines is expected to get underway by February. And we continue that. Yankton County leads the southeastern corner of South Dakota in vaccines. 614 people there have completed both doses of either the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine. In neighboring Clay County, 189 have received doses, while in Union County, that is 95. Of those three counties, Yankton has seen the largest number of cases. 2,700 plus people have been infected there and 27 have died. The highest death toll of the three is in Union County, where 36 people have died. County by county vaccine data from Nebraska is not yet available. So I believe that takes us, I think we have read everything on the front page for today, so we'll move inside. More ICUs are running out of space. Straining to handle the record number of COVID-19 patients, hundreds of the nation's intensive care units are running out of space and supplies and competing to hire temporary traveling nurses at soaring rates. Many of the facilities are clustered in the South and West. An Associated Press analysis of federal hospital data shows that since November, the share of U.S. hospitals nearing the breaking point has doubled. More than 40% of Americans now live in areas running out of ICU space, with only 15% of beds available. Intensive care units are the final defense for the sickest of the sick, patients who are nearly suffocating or facing organ failure. Nurses who work in the most stressed ICUs, changing IV bags and monitoring patients on breathing machines, are exhausted. You can't push great people forever. I mean, it just isn't possible, said Houston Methodist CEO, who is among many hospital leaders, hoping that the numbers of critically ill COVID-19 patients will have begun to plateau. Worryingly, there's an average of 20,000 new cases a day in Texas, which is the third highest death count in the country, and more than 13,000 people hospitalized with COVID-19 related symptoms. According to data, on Thursday, from the COVID tracking project, hospitalizations are still high in the West and South, with over 80,000 current COVID-19 hospital patients in those regions. The number of cases reported in the U.S. since the pandemic started surpassed 25 million on Sunday. Encouragingly, hospitalizations appear to have either plateaued or are trending downward across all other regions. It's unclear whether the easing will continue with more contagious versions of the virus arising and snags in the rollout of vaccines. In New Mexico, one surging hospital system brought in 300 temporary nurses from outside the state at a cost of millions of dollars to deal with the overflowing ICU patients who were treated in converted procedure rooms and surgery suites. It's been horrible, said the chief medical officer of Presbyterian Health Services in Albuquerque. He's comforted that the hospital never activated its plan for rationing life-saving care, which would have required a triage team to rank patients with numerical scores based on who was least likely to survive. It's a relief we've never had to do that. It sounds scary because it is. In Los Angeles, Cedars Sinai Medical Center ran into shortages of take-home oxygen tanks, which meant some patients who could otherwise go home were kept longer, taking up needed beds. But the biggest problem is competing with other hospitals for traveling nurses. Initially, when COVID surges were hitting one part of the country at a time, traveling nurses were able to go to those areas where more severely affected. Now, with almost the entire country surging at the same time, hospitals are paying 2 and 3 times more what they would normally pay for temporary traveling nurses. Houston Methodist Hospital recently paid $8,000 retention bonuses to keep staff nurses that would send them to other hotspots. Pay for traveling nurses can reach $6,000 per week, an enticement that can benefit a nurse but seems like poaching to the hospital executives. There's a lot of agencies out there who are charging ridiculous sums of money to get the ICU nurses in. They go to California in the midst of a surge, but they poach ICU nurses there, send them to Texas, where they charge inordinate amounts to fill in gaps in Texas, many of which are created because nurses in Texas went to Florida or back to California. Space is another problem. Augusta University Medical Center in Augusta, Georgia, is treating adult ICU patients under age 30 in the children's hospital. Recovery rooms have now have ICU patients, and if things get worse, other areas like operating rooms and endoscopy centers will be the next areas converted for critical care. To prevent rural hospitals from sending more patients to Augusta, the hospital is using telemedicine to help manage those patients for as long as possible in their local hospitals. It's a model I believe will not only survive the pandemic, but will flourish post-pandemic. Hospitals are pleading with their communities to wear masks and limit gatherings. There just hasn't been a lot of respect for the illness, which is disappointing, said the chief medical officer in Cullman, Alabama. He sees it changing now, with more people personally knowing someone who has died. It's taken a lot of people, he said, adding that the death toll, 144 people in 6 months in a county of 84,000, has opened their eyes to the randomness of this. All right, in local news, Morningside apartment building engulfed in flames. In Sioux City, a haze of smoke blanketed portions of the Morningside neighborhood Sunday evening as flames engulfed an apartment building along Morningside Avenue. Sioux City Fire Rescue crews were called to the fire at 1700 Morningside Avenue around 5:44 p.m. on Sunday. A fire was severe, and Deputy Fire Marshal Ryan Collins said that crews had little opportunity to go inside the building before being forced out due to a risk of collapse. Upon arrival, our crews discovered heavy smoke coming from the roof area. Upon entry, they made it to the third floor of the apartment, and they were able to search that third floor. No occupants were found, and everybody had been evacuated. Shortly thereafter, the fire's intensity quickly increased, and all crew was pulled out of the structure, and the fire department went into a defensive posture. Basically, what that means is we start pouring water on the fire from the street. The building was just too unsafe for our crews to be on the inside, he added. No residents were injured in the blaze, though Collins said some were treated on the scene for smoke inhalation. Some pets were inside at the time of the fire, and their fate is presently unknown. There were reports of missing people at first, but those occupants have been located, so everyone was accounted for. A portion of Morningside Avenue nearest the fire was closed to traffic for a time Sunday evening. The degree of damage to the apartment building, a large brick structure built in 1900, is not presently known. The damage is most likely going to be very extensive. The roof essentially has burnt off, which leads to issues with the exterior walls given the type of construction of the building. So there are collapse concerns due to the exterior walls. The number of residents displaced from the building is also unknown for certain, and the cause of the fire remains undetermined. In other briefs, a woman found dead was the daughter of a Minnesota justice. A 21-year-old who was found dead outside a sorority house at Iowa State was the daughter of a Minnesota Supreme Court justice and a prominent hospital executive, the family said. Family members identified the woman as Olivia Chutick, the daughter of Supreme Court Justice Margaret Chutick and Alena Health CEO Penny Wheeler. It is with great sadness that we confirm that Olivia, our beloved daughter, died in Ames, Iowa. Olivia was the light of our lives, and we ask for privacy as we grieve this unimaginable loss. Police in Ames said they were called to the Delta sorority house on Friday morning after an Iowa State student was found unconscious in the parking lot. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Her cause of death has not been released. The Ames Tribune reported Saturday that police said she was last seen the night before, and they believe she had been lying in the parking lot for hours before she was found. Police do not suspect foul play. A mass vaccine event in Lincoln, Nebraska could be a model. a mass vaccine event in Lincoln that helped Nebraska record one of its most productive days in its campaign to distribute shots could serve as a model for future events. Health officials in Lincoln said roughly 2,400 healthcare workers received the vaccine Friday at the event held in the Pinnacle Bank Arena that helped the state administer 8,700 doses of the vaccine on Friday, in which was the second busiest day of the campaign so far. And in Rapid City, annual count of South Dakota's homeless was called off. Organizers of South Dakota's annual point-in-time count for the state's unsheltered homeless population have been canceled this year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Sarah Hornick, a Rapid City area coordinator of homeless services for the Volunteers of America, said the count was called off mainly because of the shortage of volunteers, lack of PPE, and concerns about the spread of the COVID-19 virus. She said the vulnerable homeless population is quite large, but the Department of Housing and Urban Development decided against the count, the Rapid City Journal reported. Hornick said she's not sure how the cancellation will affect federal funding because of all the allowances in place this year because of the virus. We'll move on now to the next page. The monarch population, monarch butterflies, moves closer to extinction. In San Francisco, the number of western monarch butterflies wintering along the California coast has plummeted precipitously to a record low, putting the orange and black insects closer to extinction. An annual winter count by the Xerces Society recorded fewer than 2,000 butterflies, a massive decline from the tens of thousands tallied in recent years and millions that clustered in trees from Northern California's Marin County to San Diego County in the south in the 80s. Western monarch butterflies head south from there, the Pacific Northwest, to California each winter, returning to the same places and even the same trees, where they cluster to keep warm. The monarchs generally arrive in California the beginning of November, spread across the country once warmer weather arrives in March. On the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, another monarch population travels from southern Canada and the northeastern United States across thousands of miles to spend the winter in central Mexico. Scientists estimate the monarch population in the eastern U.S. has fallen about 80% since the mid-90s, but the drop-off in the western U.S. has been even steeper. The Xerces Society, a nonprofit environmental organization that focuses on the conservation of invertebrates, recorded 29,000 butterflies in its annual survey last winter. That was not much different than the 27,000 the year before. When the count this year is dismal, an iconic monarch wintering site in the city of Pacific Grove, volunteers said they didn't see a single butterfly this winter. Other well-known locations such as Pismo State Beach, Monarch Butterfly Grove, and Natural Bridges State Park only hosted a few hundred. These sites normally host thousands of butterflies, and their absence this year was heartbreaking for volunteers and visitors flocking to catch a glimpse of these awe-inspiring clusters of monarch butterflies. Scientists say the butterflies are at a critically low level in western states because of the destruction of their milkweed habitat along their migratory route as housing expands into their territory and use of pesticides and herbicides increase. In other news, President Joe Biden attended Mass for the first time since taking office, worshiping Sunday at a church he frequented when he was the vice president. Biden, the nation's second Catholic president, picked Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Washington's Georgetown neighborhood a few miles from the White House. It's where the nation's only other Catholic president, JFK, went to Mass. Okay, and we're going to continue on now. It is time. We do have some obituaries, and we have three today. Virginia Prince Renner of Whiting, Iowa. Virginia Prince Renner, age 91, of Whiting, Iowa, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Friday, January 22nd, in Whiting, of COVID-19, one day after her 91st birthday. She had suffered from Alzheimer's for the last 12 years and was currently a resident of Pleasant View Care Center in Whiting. Services will be 11 a.m. on Friday, January 29th at Christy Smith Funeral Home. Burial will be at a later date. Visitation following COVID guidelines will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday. The family will be wearing masks and asks that everyone do the same. Online condolences may be left at www.christysmith.com. Virginia Jean Fallon was born in Sioux City on January 21, 1930. To Clifford and Inez Fallon, she attended Whittier and East Junior High School and graduated from East High in the mid-year class of 1948. On August 28, 1949, she married William L. Prince. To this union, they had five children. Virginia was a stay-at-home mom for the rest of her life, active in her church, first at Concordia Lutheran and later at Redeemer Lutheran in Sioux City. She served many roles in the church as a church organist, children's choir director, program director, and the first woman chair of the worship committee. She was an active in the adult choir, Miriam Singers, and women's circles. Outside the home, she sang with the women's club chorus and was organist for Christy Smith Funeral Home, where she accompanied her good friend and sister-in-law, Mary Swanson. After her children were almost raised, she went to work at Bob Noller's Black Knight as a bookkeeper. Her husband, Bill, died in April of 1988, and she married John Renner in February of 1989. They had 22 years together and enjoyed camping and their grandchildren. John died on January 6th of 2011. The family wants to thank the wonderful staff at the Pleasant View Care Center for taking such good care of our mom and grandma through the last days of her life. Memorials may be directed to the Pleasant View Care Center Auxiliary in Whiting or Redeemer Lutheran Church of Sioux City. Second one is Mary Alice Collison of Albaton, Iowa. Mary Alice Collison, age 83, died Thursday, January 21st. A private family service will be January 26, 11 a.m. at the Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa. A burial will follow at the Whiting City Cemetery. Public visitation will be January 25th from 5 to 7 at the funeral home. Social distancing and masks required for visitation and the service. Friends are welcome to park in the Rush Chapel parking lot and listen to an FM station to be announced to those in attendance. Diane S. Kim, K-E-I-M. Diane Keem of Wakefield, Nebraska, age 67, died on Monday, January 18th. A memorial service will be held at a later date. The Bressler Munderloh Smith Funeral Home in Wakefield is handling arrangements. Okay, that's it for our obituaries. So now we'll go back to other news. Let's see. Biden to reinstate travel restrictions. President Joe Biden on Monday will formally reinstate COVID-19 travel restrictions on non-U.S. travelers from Brazil, Ireland, the U.K., and 23 other European countries that allow travel across open borders, according to two White House officials. The officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the order also confirmed Sunday that South Africa would be added to the restricted list because of concerns about a variant of the virus that has spread beyond the nation. Biden is reversing an order from President Donald Trump in his final days of the office that called for the relaxation of the travel restrictions. In China, rescuers carry a minor to an ambulance Sunday in Qixi City in East China's Shandong province. 11 workers were trapped for 2 weeks by an explosion inside a gold mine and were brought safely to the surface on Sunday, a landmark achievement for the industry long blighted by disasters and high death tolls. One worker was reported to have died from a head wound following an explosion that deposited massive amounts of rubble in the shaft on January 10th, while the mine was still under construction. The fate of 10 others who were underground at the time is unknown. States may ease the rules on gun restrictions. Republicans push for allowing or expanding permitless carry. In Salt Lake City, Republican lawmakers in several more states want to loosen gun restrictions by allowing people to carry concealed firearms without having to get a permit, continuing a trend that gun control advocates call dangerous. 15 states already allow concealed carry without a permit, and lawmakers in 9 others have proposed allowing or expanding the practice. GOP governors are backing the changes in Utah and Tennessee. Another bill expanding permitless carry in Montana has passed the House. Most states require people to do things like get weapons training and undergo a background check to get a permit to carry a gun hidden by a jacket or inside a purse. Groups like the NRA and state lawmakers who support gun rights argue those requirements are ineffective and undermine the Second Amendment protections. The proposed changes come after gun sales hit historic levels last summer, reflected in the FBI background checks, amid uncertainty and safety concerns about the corona pandemic and the struggling economy and protests over racial injustice. Since then, a violent mob stormed the U.S. Capitol. Against that backdrop, the efforts to loosen concealed carry requirements are a frightening trend for Shannon Watts, the founder of the gun control group called Moms Demand Action. It's dangerous to allow people to carry hidden loaded handguns, possibly without a background check or any training. In Lincoln, Nebraska, a lawsuit alleges that weeks of fraternity hazing led a University of Nebraska Lincoln student to kill himself. Cam Roken claims in a lawsuit filed in Lancaster County District Court that his brother, Rahat Jahil, was forced to stand outside all night with no clothes on and was told to urinate on other pledges who didn't follow directions before his death in January of 2019. He was 18. The suit seeks unspecified damages from Lambda Phi Epsilon International and the fraternity's Nebraska chapter. It says the fraternity did not have policies in place or enforce those that it did, nor did it provide the supervision required to ensure Jahil's safety. Okay. Katie Sheedle, an attorney representing the Nebraska chapter of Lambda Phi Epsilon, said fraternity members were saddened by the loss of their brother and refute that anything the fraternity did related to his death. The local chapter of Lambda Phi Epsilon, an Asian-centered fraternity, was founded in 2016, joining 3 other chapters in the University of Lincoln's Multicultural Greek Council. The university is not named in the lawsuit, and officials declined to comment, citing a pending litigation and an ongoing investigation. All right, we're going to continue now. Children take a dip in Lake Michigan as thunderstorms clouds approach Chicago in August. There's a picture of 3 young children playing in Lake Michigan. Illinois was one of more than a dozen states that saw population declines, according to census estimates. Population decline in 16 states last year. With a perfect storm of aging residents, low birth rates, COVID-19 deaths, and immigration cutbacks, 16 states saw population decreases last year, as the U.S. experienced the slowest national population growth since the Great Depression. The nation grew only about 7% between 2010 and 2020, similar to the previous historic low between 1930 and 1940, according to a new Census Bureau estimate, which does not reflect the 2020 census counts. The agency will release the final 2020 census tally in March. California, Massachusetts, and Ohio had been growing throughout the past decade until last year, while Michigan, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania began slides in 2019. Longer-term losses continued in Alaska, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Louisiana, Mississippi, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and West Virginia. The latest population drops could lead to economic stagnation for states. The bi-coastal tech boom has been fueled by new residents, including foreign-born students and other skilled workers using immigration visas, whilst many smaller cities and towns depend on unskilled farm or factory labor and need more immigration to stay productive. knowledge and living standards stagnate for a population that gradually vanishes, concluded Stanford University economist in a September working paper. New York and California, both hit early by the pandemic, had some of the biggest drops between mid-2019 and mid-2020, with New York losing about 126,000 people and California losing 70,000 people, according to the annual Census Bureau estimates. The annual estimates are based on births, deaths, construction permits, and other records. Illinois' population continued to drop, with a drop of about 79,000 people. New York and Illinois had the largest percentage drops in population, about 2/3 of 1% for each. The biggest gainers were Texas, up 374,000 people for the year, and Florida, up 240,000, though the figures do not take into account the coronavirus spikes that happened in those states after July. In percentage terms, the Mountain West states of Idaho, 2% growth for the year, followed by Arizona, 1.8%, Nevada and Utah at 1.5% grew fastest. We'll continue on now. Let's look at the Siouxland COVID cases by county. As of this weekend, the Woodbury County total COVID cases is 13,122 with 181 deaths. And then the next largest from that point are in Sioux County, 4,597, and Plymouth County, a little over 3,500. In Nebraska, Dakota County has had 3,762 reported cases, and Yankton County in South Dakota has had over 2,700. We're going to move on now. Mobile labs take vaccine studies to neighborhoods. In New York, Lanny Mueller doesn't have to visit a doctor's office to help test an experimental COVID-19 vaccine. She just climbs into a blood-mobile-like van that parks on a busy street near her New York neighborhood. The U.S. is rightly fixated on the chaotic rollout of the first two authorized vaccines to fight the pandemic. But with more vaccines in the pipeline, critical to boosting global supplies, scientists worry whether enough volunteers will join and stick with the testing needed to prove if they too will really work. These studies, like earlier ones, must include communities of color that have been hard hit by the pandemic, communities that also voice concern about the vaccine drive in part because of a long history of racial health disparities and even research abuses. To help, researchers in more than a dozen spots around the country are rolling out mobile health clinics to better reach minority participants and people in rural areas who would not otherwise volunteer. Mueller, who is Black, said her family was worried about the vaccine research, so she did not mention she'd signed up to test AstraZeneca's shot. The legacy of African Americans in science in these sort of trials has not been great, and we haven't forgotten, said Mueller. Excuse me. She knows more than 20 people who have gotten or died from COVID-19. I'm much more afraid of the disease than a vaccine trial, she said. From the beginning, the National Institutes of Health was adamant that COVID-19 vaccines be tested in a population about as diverse as the nation's, key to building confidence in whichever shots prove to work. In studies of the Pfizer and Moderna shots so far cleared with widespread U.S. use, 10% of the volunteers were Black and more were Hispanic. Diversity is even a tougher challenge now. The high-risk volunteers needed for final testing of other vaccine candidates have to decide if they want to stick with an experimental injection, one that might be a dummy shot, or try to get in line for a rationed but proven dosage. AstraZeneca, with about 30,000 volunteers so far, did not release specific numbers but said the last weeks of enrollment are focusing on recruiting more minorities and people over 65. Another maker, Novavax, just began recruiting for its final testing last month. Studying the vaccines in diverse populations is only one step in building trust, said President of Howard University, Howard's Hospital shared video of Frederick and other health workers getting vaccinated as a public service announcement encouraging African Americans to get their own shot as soon as possible. Frederick, a surgeon who's also at high risk because of diabetes and sickle cell disease, said he's dismayed to get emails talking about conspiracy theories that the vaccine is an experiment on African Americans. There is misinformation that does require all of us to be in the forefront of getting involved and challenging it. But efforts to build confidence in the vaccine could be undermined once there's more supply to go around. Hard-hit communities, minority communities get left behind. The equity issue is absolutely important, said Wallace, a scientist at a cancer research center, who is also part of the NIH-created COVID-19 prevention network. It's important that we ensure that the vaccine is getting to the people and that access is not an issue. Using vans to reach at-risk communities has long been a staple of fighting HIV. As more doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines arrive, mobile clinics are expected to help expand vaccination access, especially in rural areas. We're going to move on to sports, and there's a commentary, and it basically says, face it, Tom Brady is simply the best ever. Stop if you've heard this one before, but seriously, just stop. Because even in the weirdest sports times ever, what Tom Brady is doing yet again in the NFL borders on unbelievable. Forget the numbers, because they're so crazy they're barely believable. Or the fact that Brady threw interceptions on 3 straight second-half possessions in Green Bay, yet still found a way to win. Here's one you really haven't heard before. Tampa Bay is heading home to become the first team ever to host a Super Bowl 2 weeks from now in Florida. And while football is ultimately a team sport, it's all because of a 43-year-old who knew he had something left and made his teammates believe, too. The belief he gave everybody in this organization that it could be done, said Buccaneers coach, only took one man. One man with 6 Super Bowl rings who hasn't been satisfied until he has a 7th. One man who will be celebrated long after he throws his last pass as the greatest quarterback ever. And that one man has made number 12 synonymous with greatness and now has done it in 2 different uniforms. The uniform wasn't the only thing different on Championship Sunday in Green Bay. The coach on the sidelines was too. And this time Brady just needed to protect a lead in the final minutes instead of having to manufacture a winning drive. Today was a great day team effort, Brady said. We played sporadically, but the defense came up huge. It wasn't all Brady, of course. The defense kept Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers in check for the most part. And the Buccaneers got a crucial pass interference call late. And there was a head-scratching decision by the Packers to go for a field goal late and count on their defense to stop Brady and get the ball back one last time that what would be a 31-26 win. Once again, Tom Brady is in the Super Bowl. And of course, in the AFC, Kansas City ended up winning 38, Buffalo 24. So in 2 weeks will be the Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers hosting the Kansas City Chiefs. We're going to move now to some financial information. And the Motley Fool is telling us, meet the FIRE movement. Have you heard of the FIRE movement? FIRE stands for F Financial, I, independence, R, retire, E, early. Financial independence, retire early. And it's all about saving aggressively in order to retire early. As early as your 30s or even your late 20s, it's worth learning about in case you want to work toward that goal. And even if you don't, you can probably benefit from adopting some of these strategies. You may not retire early, but you might retire on time and be financially secure when you do. Some of these strategies include saving 50% or more of your earnings, increasing those earnings by taking on side jobs and cutting costs. Many FIRE enthusiasts live well below their means, often unconventionally, such as not having a car, choosing a smaller home or apartment they can afford, and not eating out. All of this may seem too extreme and unappealing to lots of us, But for many people who are way behind in saving for retirement, such strategies are worth considering. Excuse me. The FIRE movement does have some critics. Some worry that anyone retiring in their 20s and 30s might not have sufficient savings and investments to carry them for the next 60 or 70 years. Others suggest an early retirement isn't necessarily the best goal. If you have a job you enjoy, you could do well to just keep working, giving you more to spend along the way. Another knock against FIRE than financial strategy is that it involves a lot of sacrifice, deferring many enjoyments until late in life. Consider reading up on these strategies if you think they could help you reach your financial goals. And there are books out there that cover this strategy. Okay, so that's bringing us to the end of our reading for today. Today, again, is Monday, January 25th. And let's just do a quick recap of what's going on in the weather. It's going to be a cool week with possibly some flurries. Today, high of 24, cloudiness and low of 13 tonight. Cloudy with some flurries tomorrow, high of 22, low of 15. Cloudy on Wednesday, high of 25. Partly sunny on Thursday, 27. Excuse me, and warmer on Friday with clouds and sun, high of 37. I appreciate you joining me today. My name is Barb, and I have enjoyed reading for you. I hope that you have a great week. Thank you to the Sioux City Journal, and thank you to the Iowa Reading Radio Network. Take care and have a great week.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education and heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.